Cunningham.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, serving students and families who understand the benefits of a Christian liberal arts education at 1-800-944-3066.
6 minutes now past 11 o'clock. And good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Governor Jesse Ventura is backing two proposals that could dramatically change education financing in the state of Minnesota. The governor has repeatedly charged that no amount of education money ever seems to be enough. One of the big reasons, he says, is that whatever amount of money is appropriated for the schools gets quickly eaten up in higher teacher salaries, leading the school districts to immediately ask for more money. So, a couple of weeks ago, the governor gave his unqualified support to a bill moving through the legislature that would prohibit school districts from agreeing to teacher contracts that exceed the amount of money that the districts actually have to spend. Then, yesterday, the governor dropped a real bombshell when he said he may ask the legislature to change state law and bar teachers from going on strike. Taken together, the proposals could have a significant impact on education in Minnesota, and today on Midday we're going to take a closer look at those ideas. We'll be opening the phone lines for your questions and comments, but before we get started, we have a report on the governor's comments from Minnesota Public Radio's Laura McCollum.
At an education forum in St. Louis Park, the governor floated the idea to reclassify teachers as essential state employees. That would put them in the same category as police officers and firefighters who must go to binding arbitration when contract talks break down. Ventura says the Minnesota Constitution requires the state to provide public education, and the threat of teacher strikes jeopardizes children's right to get an education. Ventura says school districts, in his words, don't have the spine to get tough with teachers during contract talks, leading to contracts beyond their means.
If they know hypothetically they're only getting a 9.5% increase, and then they collectively bargain 11.5%, and then they do this twist and point the finger back at us at state government and say the problem is the governor and his budget.
Teachers union leaders reacted angrily to Ventura's idea.
Oh, it was a threat. I mean, it's a threat. He seemed like he was threatening that or money.
Sandra Peterson is vice president of Education Minnesota. She says there's no need to end teachers' right to strike.
The collective bargaining process has been sound in this state. It's worked well. We ought to continue it.
Union leaders say teacher strikes rarely occur. The last one was in 1992 in Spring Lake Park. They say Ventura is trying to divert attention from his budget, which they've described as stingy for its modest increase for K-12 education. Parents, teachers, and students have been protesting the governor's budget for weeks and warning of teacher layoffs and program cuts if lawmakers agree with Ventura's recommendations. But Ventura says the pleas for more money haven't changed his mind.
I'm not fully convinced. I will continue to, I'm very pleased that it's on the table. Again, I feel I've already won. You know, I've never made a decision based upon what do I need to do to get reelected.
Ventura has said he's the only politician who can take on the education lobby because he doesn't accept special interest money. He's described education as a dark hole and questioned whether any amount of money would satisfy districts. Lawmakers gave schools an additional $1.3 billion over the last 2 years. The governor says he's proposed a 4.4% increase in K-12 funding over the next 2 years, although union officials dispute that figure. Ventura is also backing a bill opposed by the teachers union that would prohibit school boards from approving teacher contracts that exceed anticipated revenues. The bill's House author is Republican Mark Biskins of Jordan, an assistant principal. Biskins says too many districts assume state education funding will increase every year.
Of course it probably will. It always has. That's the history. But to assume that then leaves this roller coaster of up and downs, and every 2 years talking about cuts and increased class sizes and teacher layoffs that I think we need to get over.
Biskin's bill was approved by the House Education Committee on a party line vote this week, but its prospects are uncertain in the DFL-controlled Senate. The chances for the governor's latest idea to reclassify teachers are even more uncertain. Lawmakers' reaction ranged from instant dismissal to mild interest. Ventura's predecessor, Republican Governor Arne Carlson, pushed the same idea, but he says it met with fierce opposition.
And I think Governor Ventura, to his credit, is raising some very valid questions about collective bargaining and financial accountability. I think there are questions that the legislature should wrestle with.
It's unclear whether the legislature will wrestle with the essential employee idea this session. While Ventura says he's likely to push the issue, a bill hasn't been drafted and no sponsors have been identified. At the Capitol, I'm Laura McCullum, Minnesota Public Radio.
Well, joining us now is the president of the Teachers Union Education Minnesota, Judy Schaubach. Also with us is Greg Vandell, who is the president of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. He is also the superintendent of the Sauk Rapids Rice School District in central Minnesota. And we invite you to join our conversation as well. We're talking this hour about two proposals to significantly change the way teacher contracts are negotiated in Minnesota. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828. Greg Vandell, Judy Schaubach, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Good morning, Gary.
Judy Schaubach, let me start with you. At the heart of both of these proposals seems to be the notion that school districts often agree to pay teachers more than the school districts can actually afford. And by that, we would mean teacher contracts that require the district to lay off teachers, cut programs, or ask the state for more money. How common is that?
Well, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about these numbers that are thrown out. So when the governor talks about an increase that exceeded the amount of revenue, he's taking the actual percentage of a salary and benefit increase and comparing it with the new revenue that the district had. And I'd like to just give you a brief example of how that doesn't actually result in the district spending more money than they have. Let's say that a district gets a 10% revenue increase for the 2 years, for the biennium. So if the district made a decision that they were going to spend more than 10% on salary and benefits, then that means that they would spend less than 10% on other parts. They have a pie, if you will, and that total amount of revenue that they have is divided up into a lot of different categories. Mm-hmm. Teacher salaries only make up 40% of the budget on average statewide. 40% are for teacher salaries. Now, when you include all salaries and benefits district-wide, the number gets higher. But just in terms of teacher salaries, that percentage has actually decreased each year for the last 10 years. So maybe another way to look at it, I can actually give you a specific example. There was a district who, over the last 2 years, got a 7.09% increase in their revenue. And they settled a 2-year settlement for the contract of 7.83%. Now that seems like it would be more money than they had available the way we're hearing this described. The reality is that the increase in terms of the percentage of the revenue that was actually spent was only half of 1%. And partly that's because the entire school district budget isn't just teacher salaries. And also there's a change in the mix of who's actually being employed by the district. In other words, people retire, new people come in, so it changes the actual amount of money that needs to be spent for those teacher salaries. So to just say if a settlement is 11%, then and the school district got 9% new revenue, that the school district is being irresponsible and has spent more money than they have is just not true.
Mm-hmm. Greg Vandell, would you agree with that?
I agree with some of the math that Judy is projecting. I also recognize that there are challenges in balancing budgets, and one of the challenges is to compensate our employees fairly under the rules of the game and to make our budgets work. I just found the proposal by the governor to be an interesting one at an interesting time because it came toward the end of a session devoted exclusively to whether or not there was adequacy in the education funding proposal that's before the legislature. And suddenly, instead of talking about the adequacy of revenue, which most of us believe is not there, we're talking about teacher bargaining. In some ways, it feels a bit like misdirection. And while we might be interested in having discussions about the rules of collective bargaining, our focus right now needs to be on securing the resources necessary to maintain high-quality schools.
Mm-hmm. But let's focus on the collective bargaining aspects of that because there are these two proposals out there which are, if for no other reason, garnering a lot of attention. Mitzi Greiling, who is a DFL state representative from Roseville, former school board member, says it was quoted in one of the stories in the Star Tribune recently as saying the state doesn't give the schools enough money to spend the way they want. But she goes on to say the schools are spending money as if they're getting all they wanted, suggesting that, in fact, the governor is on to something here, that school districts are spending in excess of what they reasonably should be spending.
I was a little distressed with some of the language, and I have not heard the governor quoted directly as saying that that we're spineless as boards of education and as school systems. In fact, we bargain in good faith according to the rules established by the state legislature put into place over the course of the last three decades in Minnesota. So we operate in accordance with what's called Public Employee Labor Relations Act. That isn't a function of spine. It's a function of what exists, what tools we have available to us under the law. And I'm going to suggest that there are those that would look at the tools and say that they, if in the face of a very strong union advocacy, the tools might be skewed in the favor of a union. I know that if I were sitting here as the union president, I would argue the contrary. The fact of life is that over the course of three decades, we have had some labor disputes in the state, and I would count our successes as greater than our failures. But the discussion about PELRA within the right context is probably appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Judy Shylock, do you think the playing field is not level at this point, that that you folks, because of a series of regulations and laws and the rest, that you folks, when you go to the bargaining table, really have a big advantage here? I mean, school districts are in a position where they get penalized if they don't reach agreement by January 15th. It's a public relations disaster, if nothing else, if in fact teachers do go on strike. It does seem to give you folks all the cards.
Well, I don't think that that's accurate. I think actually in many of our districts, people feel that just the opposite is true. But I think we have to look at what have the results been. The fact of the matter is that over the last decade, there have been very, very few teacher strikes. In fact, there hasn't been one since 1992. There has been much more interest-based or collaborative bargaining, where school union officials and school district officials are sitting down and trying to really focus on mutually finding solutions for the problems. If in fact teachers had such an upper hand, then I would argue that teacher salaries would be much more competitive than they are right now. The reality is that teacher salaries aren't keeping up. We're having more and more trouble recruiting teachers to the profession and keeping them. One of the things that we can look at is our rank among our peers. And we're 19th right now in the country in terms of average teacher salary. We're actually below the national average by about $1,200. And even in terms of Minnesota wage earners, I found this very interesting. You know, we've had a lot of prosperity here in Minnesota over the last decade, and Minnesota wage earners have increased their salaries by 33% over the last 10 years, where the average growth of wages for Minnesota teachers has only been 23%. So if anything, I would argue that we're not keeping up, that we actually are not enjoying the same prosperity as other workers here in Minnesota. So I think that would argue that, I think that begs the point of who really has the most power. One of the things that I think that I totally agree with Mr. Bandel on is that we have really diverted the discussion, and I'm very disappointed by that. The real issue facing us right now is, are we going to adequately fund our schools? We're not talking about increases in salaries. We're talking about major cuts, up to 3,000 teachers that may be cut if this budget that the governor's proposed is enacted. We're talking about the result of that being increased class size and program offerings being cut. And I think it's very unfortunate that we're diverted to something else, which, you know, we certainly can have discussions about, and we continue to have discussions about. But the real issue here that I think all of the people in the education community and the parents and the students are concerned about is, what are we going to do to make sure that we support our public schools so that we can continue to have a high-quality public education system in the state?
Mm-hmm. But I would, you know, not to put words in the governor's mouth, but I would imagine he would argue, well, the reason, to the extent that those cutbacks and layoffs are going to be necessary, is because school districts have given away the store in the past. They got a big bump the last couple of years, or last year, gave it all away in teacher salaries, and now there's this problem, which would get to the heart of his criticism of the way the process works. Mr. Bandel?
Well, I'm not going to dispute anything that Judy said, especially if we're going to run down CPI indices and things like that. I use the same data, and I need to state unequivocally, I don't think our teachers in Minnesota are paid enough. They're a high-quality workforce. They do a marvelous job on behalf of our kids. The challenge has been that with the resource that we have available to us, we haven't been able to maintain that competitiveness on a national basis, and we've fallen in rank. I'm not going to lay that at the doorstep of collective bargaining. I'm going to lay that at the doorstep of a revenue stream that has not kept pace with inflation over the course of time. Now, the governor can suggest, and I think rightfully so, that collective bargaining is challenging, and that within the context of the revenue that's been available to us, schools have had difficult decisions to make. But we balance those decisions with the need to compete with a workforce, especially in the last few years, that pays considerably more than what we can pay our teachers. I'll give you an example. I've got an industrial technology teacher here, top-notch teacher, nationally recognized. You know, works for 25 years for me, makes about $45,000 to $50,000 a year, has a son that he wants to bring into industrial technology, talks him into going to school. The guy gets ready to go out into the field to become a teacher and is hired in his first year in industry for about the same amount that his dad is making after having worked for nearly 30 years as a teacher. We have a difficult time competing under that kind of a circumstance, and we are, in fact, competing with private industry for our workforce.
We're talking this hour about two proposals that the governor is backing. One, which has actually been introduced at the legislature, would make some changes in the way that school districts handle teacher contract negotiations, requiring them to make sure that the contract agreements they reach do not exceed the revenues that they actually have in hand. The other proposal, which is not a formal legislative proposal yet, but one that the governor was talking publicly about yesterday, would take away the right to strike from teachers, prevent them from striking, and define them as essential employees. The governor argues that at this point the field is not level, that teacher negotiations with the school boards are not a fair fight at all. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here. We're talking today with Judy Schaubach, who is the president of Education Minnesota. Greg Vandell has joined us, president of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Our Twin City area number, 651-227-6000, or 1-800-242-2828. Roger, go ahead, please.
Yes, I would like to agree with both Judy Schaubach and Greg Vandell. I have spent 40 years in public education, mostly at the higher education level. In working with teachers in the K-12 area, I've had interest in that area. I'd like to make a couple of comments. One is about the essential employees issue.
Mm-hmm.
I taught at North Hennepin Community College when Governor Jesse Ventura was a student there, and I can tell you that after watching him as governor in the last couple of years, this is just another example of Jesse's very thin skin. I'll give you three examples. When the media asks stringent basic questions, calls the media jackals.
Okay, Roger, let's stay on topic here, though.
The legislature is not going to remove the Pelera's strike provisions. If we take away the teacher's right to strike, we're going to return to the effective collective begging of the 50s and 60s. Many legislatures, Gary, have looked at collective bargaining for educators for a long period of time. In fact, the school boards have really been beating up the teachers for 30 years. If we go to the bargaining table, the power is on the board's side because of what Mr. Vandell has said. The board has been given legislative appropriations. They have limited numbers of funds, and you can't bargain beyond that. Gary, if we were bargaining the way we ought to be bargaining in this state, the teachers wouldn't be starting at half the rate that my college graduates are starting at now in the 50s and 60s.
Okay.
Thousands.
Okay. Thanks, Roger. Appreciate the comments.
Some interesting observations about that. Early in this conversation, I tried to say that my experience is that teachers haven't been beating up on boards, and in defense of boards, I don't believe that boards by and large have been beating up on teachers. I think that when both parties approach the table in good faith, that there's been most often a positive outcome, and that has been the case. While I would be interested in taking a look at some of the finer points of Pelera, I'm going to suggest that the essential employee language of that rhetoric is not necessarily the approach to go. Matter of fact, from a management perspective, we have one group in our school system right now that is declared an essential employee group, and that's our principals. And they can bring us straight into arbitration, and they can decide on the type of arbitration that they might wish to have. And that isn't something that we even have available to us under the current teacher bargaining laws. So essential employee language isn't necessarily a tool that gives more strength to boards of education. It may, in fact, strip some of our tools right now.
So you would be opposed to this notion of binding arbitration as a replacement for the right to strike?
And I didn't say that I would be opposed to a binding arbitration provision. I suggested that I'd be opposed to the essential employee language as it currently exists in our schools today. If we were going to talk about arbitration, I think there are some changes that might be able to be made in arbitration, and Judy and I probably wouldn't agree on those, but like I say, those are the finer points of a collective bargaining process that most often works.
Mm-hmm. Judy Schaubach, would you be willing to give up the right to strike for a binding arbitration provision? As I understand it, the School Boards Association is suggesting that if an agreement weren't reached by, I believe it's September 1st, then this binding arbitration clause would kick in.
Well, you know, certainly there are times when binding arbitration is the right solution. But I think, again, that's best decided at the local level. Right now, people can decide mutually to go to binding arbitration, or they can decide to exercise their right to strike. We think that system's working very well. We think there have been very few strikes, that by and large, people are able to settle the contracts without that. So we're not at this point supporting a change. And again, this just came up sort of out of thin air. And as Greg said, the real issue is, are we going to have the revenue to do what we need to do? Both the school board, the administrators, and or all of us, the school board, the administrators, and the teachers and other education employees all want to have adequate resources so that we can adequately compensate people without having to go on strike, so we don't have to cut programs and we don't have to increase class size. And those are all the trade-offs that we're going to have to face if there isn't adequate funding.
Beth, your next place. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just an average mom with two kids and that attend a public school system, and I am so frustrated with this entire debate. I have to admit, I support Jesse Ventura's approach to this, that he is really holding the education people their feet to the fire to say, where is this money going? Once again, Ms. Schaubach just mentioned that with the cuts that you're going to be getting with this budget, from what I understand, this is not a cut, that his appropriations for education have gone up. So I find it disingenuous, and I find it very misleading, and I don't know who to listen to anymore, because you start talking percentages of this and this pie and that pie. Well, you know, it's like statistics. Anybody can read them any way they want. I would really like to know where I can get some factual information. As far as the reason why there hasn't been any strikes, maybe that's because, as Jesse has stated, the school boards are held hostage by the unions here. Maybe that's the reason why the teachers are happy and don't want it to change.
Okay.
I just know one thing. I am not at all happy with the public school my daughter attends. Not at all. District 15. The teachers, the quality of teachers, the quality of the education is just not there. She comes home and is talking about honors classes being cut and this and that and this and that. And it's just such a mess. I would really like to look at the state turning this over to private industry.
All right,
and let them deal with it.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you.
Greg Vandell, there hasn't been a teacher's strike in Minnesota since 1992. Is that a sign that the system is working, or is it a sign that the system is not working?
I don't think it's an either-or question. I think in some places the system is working, and in some places it's not. I'd like to be responsive to Beth, the average mom, because I've heard the same kinds of frustrations coming out of some of the average moms and dads in my own district. I'm going to suggest there's a place that the best of this world can turn for information. The School Board Association is an organization comprised of moms and dads and non-parents who are elected to represent the citizens of their school districts, and they've joined together in something called the School Board Association. The School Board Association data looks at the Ventura budget and comes to the same conclusion that school administrators and teachers have come to, and that is that there isn't 4% new money in that Ventura budget. What there is an accounting for increased numbers of students to be served. And since we're paid based on the number of students that we serve, we're going to see new money where we have new students. nowhere near the 4%, I might add. I took the state numbers, the numbers produced by the governor's office. I brought them to the Department of Children, Families, and Learning, Finance Division. I used the state's tools to analyze those numbers. We're a growing district, and as a growing district, we face a 0.5% reduction in funding next year. That's not a reduction from an increase. That's a reduction in funding. And in the following year, a greater reduction in funding. This is not new money for the schools of Minnesota, and parents should be aware that, any claims of more money in this education budget are disingenuous.
Well, Christine Jacks is out today, the Commissioner of Children's Families and Learning, with a editorial on the website saying once again that indeed you folks are playing fast and loose with the numbers, that indeed most districts will get more money, and it is difficult for people to know who to believe.
Well, it's very difficult, particularly because what the state claims as new money is money that's going to reduce property taxes. And that is not new money that school districts see. It's new money that the state spends, but it doesn't result in school districts getting new money. And that's where a lot of this confusion enters in, and I think it is very confusing for parents. Let's take St. Paul, for example. They just passed an excess levy referendum of about $26 million. They did that to reduce class size and to put in place some programs. But because of the funding level that the state is going to provide to St. Paul, they're going to have to use that money just to maintain the basic programs, and they're not going to be able to deliver the things that the taxpayers voted to have done. And I think that creates a lot of cynicism among the public because they're believing they're raising their own taxes to do these things. But unfortunately, the state isn't meeting its obligation so that the local property people actually can do the additional things with the money that they've raised.
And back to this issue of collective bargaining changes that are being talked about, would it be fair to say, given the fiscal realities, and of course hindsight's always 20/20, did the St. Paul School Board in that case provide teachers with too big of a raise in salary, given the fact that their funding didn't increase? Did they go too far out on a limb when they should have held back to see how much money was going to be available?
Well, I think salaries in St. Paul were very modest the last 2 years. You know, the thing that is increasing way above the cost of inflation are things like health insurance costs, heating, transportation costs. Those are the things that are much more difficult to predict, that are going up way, way above the cost of inflation. So those things are really contributing to the additional unanticipated costs in school districts.
I can't speak to the St. Paul settlement. I can speak to settlements in general because there's a connectedness. Just as grocery stores, across the corner from one another have to be aware of what their price points are, schools also need to be aware that if we're going to be attracting and retaining employees, we have to know what the price points are in our industry. And so consequently, what happens is that schools keep an eye on what the salary rates are and what the benefit packages are in other places because our employees do. And especially in the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen a tremendous transition, a move from place to place as people have found better packages. Now, this happens in private industry all the time, and nobody even blinks an eye. What we need to do is to make certain that we can both attract and retain the employee base that is required to maintain high-quality schools.
That's Greg Vandell. He is the president of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Judy Schaubuck is with us. She's co-president of the Teachers Union, Education Minnesota. We're talking this hour about a couple of proposals that have been floated to change the way that teacher contracts are negotiated in the state of Minnesota. If you'd like to join our conversation again, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to more of your calls here in a couple of minutes.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, with Contralto Ava Podlish performing Handel and Gluck arias at 4 Metro locations, March 21st through 24th. Tickets at www.thespco.org.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week on The Splendid Table, we're off to a culinary city in the making, Shanghai, China. And then in our own neck of the woods, Jane Stern?
We have found, bar none, the absolute best fried chicken in the entire world.
Talk about sweeping statements. That's The Splendid Table, Saturday at 1 and Sunday at 6 a.m. on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW-FM 91.1.
Just a reminder, Minnesota Public Radio is member-supported, and we'd like to say thank you to all of our loyal and generous members. News headlines now. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Thanks, Gary, and good morning. The stock market is continuing to fall this morning. The Dow has declined more than 300 points during this morning's session. With a drop now of 20% from last year's high, the Dow is considered in a bear market. It joins the tech-heavy NASDAQ composite and the broader S&P 500, which had already crossed that benchmark. In fact, the NASDAQ is down more than 60% from its record of 5,048. Discount broker Charles Schwab announced today it plans to cut its workforce by 3,400 jobs. Procter & Gamble is also cutting jobs. The consumer products giant is announcing another 9,600 job cuts in its worldwide workforce. President Bush says he's confident expelling dozens of Russian diplomats was the right decision. He says he still hopes for a good working relationship with Moscow. U.S. officials say four Russians involved in the Hansen spy case have been told to leave immediately. 46 more have been given until the summer to leave, the largest expulsion since the Cold War. Moscow is expected to also expel some U.S. diplomats. The government will let diabetics get their first painless way to measure blood sugar. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a wristwatch-like device to do the job. The GlucoWatch checks sugar levels every 20 minutes by sending tiny electric currents through the skin. FDA officials say the GlucoWatch is a supplement to the fingerstick test. In regional news, the state veterinarian says he's meeting with the Department of Public Safety to establish safety measures in case a foot and mouth disease outbreak occurs in Minnesota. Officials say the chances for an outbreak in Minnesota are slim. The McKnight Foundation will give the Duluth-based Northland Foundation up to $7 million over the next 5 years for economic development. The Northland Foundation is one of six regional funds set up by McKnight 15 years ago to build Minnesota's rural economies. The forecast for Minnesota calls for cloudy skies in the north and central portions of the state this afternoon. High temperatures ranging from 25 in the northwest to near 40 in the southeast. At this hour, Duluth reports partly cloudy skies and 35 degrees. Skies are partly cloudy in Rochester and 31. It's cloudy in Moorhead and 18 degrees. And in the Twin Cities, cloudy skies with a temperature of 33. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
Thanks, Greta. 22 minutes before noon. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. And let's get back to our callers. Lots of people on the line with questions for our guests. Judy Shava, co-president of Education Minnesota. Greg Vandell, the president of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. He's also superintendent of the Sauk Rapids Rice School District. We're talking this hour about a couple of proposals, one moving through the legislature, which would essentially require school districts to certify that they actually have enough money coming in to fulfill the contract agreements that they reach with teachers. Excuse me, the other voted by the governor yesterday, he said maybe it's time that teachers lose the right to strike. R.J. is on the line from Crookston with a question. Go ahead, R.J.
Hi, and a comment if I could, too, please. I think what's confusing for a lot of parents, and I'm a parent of three small children, is that there are so many numbers floating out there, and the system has become so politicized that it's hard to determine who's telling the truth. And I think part of that is that there's this move to equate quality with increased spending. So the only way to have quality is to increase spending in education. Granted, you have to have increases, but you can't write blank checks to Education Minnesota. If you would ask teachers in a certain school district what their ideal budget would be for that district, they would give you a certain figure. But the school boards have to react to that with reality. And I think, unfortunately, there's this concern that because there is not as much of an increase in spending, that the quality somehow is being hurt. And I do support Governor Ventura's ideas, by the way. I think a point to that is that up here in Crookston, in northwest Minnesota, we have a school district that's losing 100 students every year to surrounding school districts because of open enrollment. And the parents that I've talked to, the reasons why they're pulling their kids out of the local school to the smaller schools is because these smaller schools are emphasizing more of the basics in their curriculum, and they have more funds directed toward those basics.
Okay, RJ, could you get to your point here then?
Well, the point is, I think that as we look at the future for education in the state, the school boards have to have latitude, and they can't really be held over a barrel with an this-or-nothing attitude. you.
All right.
Interesting that it calls from Crookston. I know the Crookston school system reasonably well. I'm married to a graduate from the Crookston system, and my in-laws keep me apprised of what's happening. And in Crookston, Minnesota, a tremendous number of cuts that have had to take place in a fine school system over the course of the last decade. Some of it attributed to open enrollment, but you get into kind of a death spiral. As you have economic difficulties, you can't offer programs that the neighbors might be able to offer, and so people leave for the neighbors, and you get into greater economic difficulty. Fundamentally, this is a question of resource. It comes back again to a question of resource and whether that resource is adequate. Again, I would suggest you turn to the School Board Association. Though the School Board Association has had to move into a political arena to secure funds, the School Board Association is largely apolitical. It represents citizens. Their data would show you over the course of time that schools have been inadequately funded. Now again, the School Board Association might have positions contrary to the Education Minnesota on collective bargaining, but collective bargaining is not the issue today. It is a part of the issue, but the real issue is the adequacy of resource, and that is simply not an adequate amount of money to fund our schools. We don't even have inflationary indexes built into this budget.
Okay. And as Greg mentioned, I've been up to Crookston several times in the last year, and the declining enrollment is a real challenge in some of our rural school districts, as it is beginning to be even in the metro area. We have Minneapolis, for example, that's going to be looking at declining enrollment. But particularly in small districts, the cost of maintaining the school and offering programs, even with declining enrollment, it doesn't equate to exactly the number of students that leave. So you lose funding for each student, but you still have to do a lot of the basic things like heat the school and provide some of the courses that you need. So there's an additional challenge in how we fund these schools that have declining enrollment. But I would agree with Greg. I think you should talk to the school board up in Crookston and talk with them about what's going on, because I think that, again, it's the lack of funding that's really creating the problem. And I just want to comment on the quality. You know, one of the things about quality that does cost money is if we're going to have class sizes that are reasonable so that we can give individual attention to students and we can provide a safe and orderly environment, that's a costly proposition. And if we're going to hire high-quality people and keep them in the profession, there's a cost associated with that. And, you know, the single biggest factor in how well students do is how well qualified their teachers are. And we have had a history here in Minnesota of having very highly qualified professionals in the classroom, and that's resulted in very high student outcomes. So there is some degree of correlation between quality and cost.
Mm-hmm. And back to the central question again, in an effort to keep the schools strong, to attract the good teachers, do school boards in Minnesota tend to say, well, gosh, it costs us all, let's say, $1 million to run the schools this year. And we don't really know how much money we're going to get, but what the heck, we'll sign off a teacher agreement because we want the good teachers. That will cost us $1.1 million to run the schools next year and then hope that the state will come through for money. Does that happen?
Well, I wish collective bargaining were as simple as you just described and that school budgets were assembled in that fashion. Let's take a look at the structural balance language you talked about a little bit earlier. From the outset, schools must be structurally balanced. We must match revenues and expenditures, and so consequently, we have to always keep an eye on the budget. It's illegal for us to be in debt over the course of time, and if we are, then the state takes us over. So we do watch budgets. We do not arbitrarily settle contracts. We bargain in good faith, sometimes for months on end. We keep an eye on what's happening in our neighborhood in terms of the market, in terms of the statewide market, and we settle contracts as we know best serve the needs of the school system and try to fairly compensate our employees in the process. It's not as simple as saying, oh, well, we simply have to pay these darn teachers more money. It feels like that sometimes when you get into conflict, but that's not usually what goes on.
What does happen, though, is that the point, then, if you've committed, you decide you really need the good teachers, pay them more, so now you're up to 1.1, mm-hmm. to make sure that you're balanced, is that where, at that point, you start cutting back programs, maybe laying off teachers, paying some more, but laying off, is that where that process sets in, then?
Like any business, we try to look out ahead as well as look back at trends. And so what ends up happening is we try to maintain as much as possible an even program keel and an even budget keel so that we're not, making huge changes in operation on a year-to-year basis. So as we settle contracts, that's the philosophy that's taken into account. The other thing that happens is the school districts plan to grow programs, and we're a district that's going to be opening a new building, and we know we've got infrastructure costs associated with that. We try to plan out ahead, and so we try to settle collective bargaining agreements so that we're able to plan for an increased expenditure requirement in years to come.
I think right now, as we look at what school districts are facing, it isn't that they've overcommitted to the teacher salaries or other costs in the district. It's that there have been escalating costs, and right now we do not have an inflationary increase built into the budget. Most state agencies automatically have been appropriated some cost of living increase, but school districts aren't getting that right now. What they're looking at is maintain, at best, having the same amount of revenue to do not just the same thing, but to meet the increased costs associated with, again, health insurance, fuel, trying to continue to reduce class size and do those things. So it isn't that they've overspent. It's just that they're at a point where they need some inflationary increase because all the other costs in operating the school district are going up.
I also want to make an observation about collective bargaining. Just like any law, typically laws are written for the extremes, not written for the standard practice, so to speak. I think I could argue there are places in this state where school boards may have had an upper hand over the course of time, and wages and benefits have been held low. And there are places in this state where it might be argued that unions have had an upper hand, and we have wages and benefit packages that are very, very difficult for boards to afford. But by and large across the state, we have places, we have districts bargaining in good faith. Now, those places where we believe union has upper hand, then we're interested in changes in PELRA which can strengthen the hand of the Board of Education. Education Minnesota would probably say in the places where the board has felt like they've had the upper hand, we need to make the changes in PELRA to turn the power back over to the teachers' groups. I really think fundamentally, though, that most places bargaining in good faith where there's adequate resource have been able to find a balance point that works for everyone.
Okay. Very briefly.
Okay, I was going
to
say, you know, one of the things that I think we actually have in common now is that we have to be competitive in the market. And in some of the small districts where salaries are extremely low, school boards and administrators are concerned because they're not able to recruit the kind of people that they need. So we all have a mutual interest in being competitive in the market.
Sid, your comment, please.
Gary, you're one of the best jackals in town. This is a great program. Thanks for taking my call.
Proud to be a jackal, I guess.
Well, I'm calling to add a little balance here. You have two people on one side who have a lot of great opinions, but, you know, as in all opinions, we all have them. Some of the misconceptions I've been hearing Judy and Greg talk about are, you know, salary and benefits and balance compared to the general workforce. Teachers in Minneapolis make an average salary of $58,000 a year plus benefits for 172 days with the kids. Their contract is for 198 days total. Now, if you're in the union, you'll make $52,000 a year for 40 hours a week. That's after you become a journeyman. And that's before they take out all sorts of deductions for a whole variety of things.
Okay.
The salaries are not the same. Now, that's not all. What you have to look at here is there's a whole bunch of issues they've been touching on that really are very different than what it is they've been portraying them as.
Okay, we'll pick out one because we don't have a whole lot of time here, Sid.
The salary that they, you know, it's a salary issue here to begin with. You cannot compare a teacher who's working 198 days total a year, that's what they're paid for, with a tradesman who's working 40 hours a week, 7 days a week in the cold, whatever. Now, that's one. And if you'd like, we could also talk about, you know, some of the surplus referendum issues that she was talking about and whether or not Minneapolis says they're meeting the referendum or St. Paul says they're meeting the referendum issues or whether they're, in fact, not spending the money as they say they're spending. Okay, there's another issue.
Okay, Sid. Well, let's, setting aside whether teachers actually get paid enough money, because I think that's a subject for a different program. In general, do you folks think that the way the system operates now, the bargaining system, is that leading us, leading the state of Minnesota, to a pretty reasonable result in terms of teachers being paid about what they should be paid, given the amount of money available in the kitty there?
That's a very big question, Gary. Let me just comment quickly on what the gentleman just said. If those numbers are right, a $58,000 average salary, then I'm going to lose all of my workforce because I know Minneapolis is looking for teachers. That's fully $20,000, $25,000 more than average salaries that I'm familiar with out here. This is not about salaries. This is about bargaining. I would suggest that Judy and I might not agree on the finer points of negotiations, and I'm not trying to bait an argument. I would suggest that we need to make some changes in arbitration. I don't doubt that we each have interests on either side of this management union issue. But if we're talking about issues of adequacy of funding, I need to keep coming back to that. In an environment where we have at least inflationary increases built into funding formulas, this is a process that works a lot better than in an environment where we have no inflationary increase at all.
Judy?
Well, I think that, as Greg just said, the average teacher's salary in Minneapolis is whatever it is. You know, one of the things that's happening is that we're having people actually leave districts and go to other places. They're being recruited away. So does the process work? Well, I would argue that maybe there are things that we should change because it shouldn't take 20 years to make a professional level salary, that we ought to be more competitive statewide so that people aren't leaving Greg's district to go to Minneapolis. You know, there needs to be maybe some more equity and comparability of salaries statewide. So there are a lot of issues to deal with. But by and large, the collective bargaining system that we have has resulted in a more positive environment in terms of labor and management than in many other states. So I think that speaks to the fact that, by and large, the system we have is working well.
We were talking earlier about the suggestion that maybe we move to a system of binding arbitration. One other proposal would be that the legislature eliminate this deadline, the January 15th deadline for reaching contract agreements, teacher contract agreements. Part and parcel of that is that if agreements aren't reached, then the school districts are penalized $25 per student. Should that provision be dropped?
Well, we actually think that the provision ought to remain. We weren't originally supportive or non-supportive of the idea, but we knew that in many districts, prolonged negotiations were going on and that wasn't helpful to the school environment. It's very interesting to look at the impact of the deadline. The first year of the deadline, there were 433 of the districts that settled on time. The 1 year, a year ago, the settlement deadline was lifted, and we had huge numbers of districts that did not settle. Now you might say, well, then that's an unfair advantage to one side or the other. But the reality is that whether you have the January 15th deadline or don't, the settlements are virtually the same. And in fact, the settlements after the deadline went down rather than up. So we think the deadline actually serves an effective purpose.
Greg Vandell, not a lot of time, but I'd like to get your comment on that.
Well, the deadline does set a threshold for us, but if we're talking about an issue of local control, we don't get to control that part of our calendar. I understand, however, that we can't prolong negotiations forever. It's a complex issue, certainly. I have not faced that deadline in any serious fashion in my own school system, so consequently it's difficult for me to have a personal opinion. Professionally, I'd say that local boards and local teachers units should have the opportunity to bargain in good faith, and if it takes longer than January 15th, it does. We shouldn't face a financial penalty for our good faith negotiations.
Folks, we're out of time, but I appreciate you joining us today, shedding a little light on this issue. Thanks for coming by today. Our guests this hour, Greg Vandell, who is the president of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and Judy Shaba, co-president of Education Minnesota, the teachers union in the state of Minnesota, coming by today to talk about a couple of proposals, one that's moving through the legislature, which would require school districts to certify that they're not spending more money than they actually have. The other, an idea floated by the governor yesterday, that teachers essentially lose their right to strike and that the system be replaced by binding arbitration. 5 minutes now before 12 o'clock here on Midday.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 22nd of March, 2001. It's the birthday of Marcel Marceau, born in Strasbourg, France, in 1923, who managed in the second half of the 20th century almost single-handedly to revive the ancient art of pantomime. He was active in the French Resistance during World War II and then founded his own mime troupe in 1948 and swiftly became the world's best-known mime. His best-known character, the clown Bip, in sailor pants and striped jacket. Marcel Marceau, who also devised the mime drama Don Juan and the mime ballet Candide. It's the birthday of novelist Nicolas Montserrat, born in Liverpool, 1910, served in the Royal Navy during World War II, worked on the Atlantic convoy runs, and wrote a novel about it during the war, H.M. Corvette. It came out in 1942. He's best known for another wartime sea saga, The Cruel Sea, about life on board a small ship in wartime. It came out in 1951. It's the birthday of Western writer Louis L'Amour, born in Jamestown, North Dakota, 1908. He left school when he was 15 to travel the world, traveled around the West. He was a miner for a time, traveled to East Africa, worked as an elephant handler, lumberjack, boxer, migrant farm worker, and in his 30s began writing novels about life on the Western frontier. His first big success was Hondo in 1953. It was made into a John Wayne movie. All through the 50s and 60s and 70s, he wrote 7 or 8 books a year. Wrote 100 of them in all, which sold over 200 million copies worldwide. It's the birthday of the French-Canadian writer Gabriel Roy, born in St. Boniface, Manitoba, 1909. Lived in Montreal, wrote many French-language novels set there, including Bonheur d'Occasion, translated as The Tin Flute. It's the birthday of illustrator Randolph Caldecott, born in Chester, England, 1846, who illustrated books by Washington Irving and the poem The House That Jack Built, two children's books in the 1870s, the Caldecott Medal for the illustrator, the best picture book for children, is named for him. Here's a poem for today, some lines from William Wordsworth's Ode, Intimations of Immortality. There was a time when meadow, grove, and stream, the earth and every common sight, to me did seem apparelled in celestial light, the glory and the freshness of a dream. It is not now as it has been of yore. Turn wheresoe'er I may, by night or day, the things which I have seen, I now can see no more. The rainbow comes and goes, and lovely is the rose. The moon doth with delight look round her when the heavens are bare. Waters on a starry night are beautiful and fair. The sunshine is a glorious birth, but yet I know, where'er I go, that there hath passed away a glory from the earth. Lines from Ode, Intimations of Immortality by William Wordsworth. That's the Writer's Almanac, brought to you by the people at 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find 13 million gently read classics, bestsellers, rare masterpieces on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Production assistance from Tom Kubasik. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcast.